When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. Happy New Year to you all. The new year and, well, great opportunities for England, obviously, this summer. Probably the biggest summer of cricket ever in England, certainly since the 1970s with the World Cup and the Ashes. And in this programme, we're going to look at the new England Director of Cricket, Ashley Giles. We've got some comments from him. We're also going to draw some tickets for the Ashes Test match at Lord's. That's after the break, so stay listening for that. We're going to review the Australia-India 4-Test series, that amazing win by India, 2-1 in the series, their first ever win on Australian soil in a Test series. And we're going to answer your daughter's riddle, Simon, as well. Marina's riddle last week. We'll play a little bit of that after the break. Do you know the answer to that?
I do know the answer to it, but I needed her to really slow down and speak very slowly before I was able to work it out.
Have you taught her much about elocution?
Not yet, no, not yet. That's all to come. She teaches me things, tells me what to do.
Anyway, the announcement a couple of weeks ago that Ashley Giles was taking over as the director of cricket for England, taking over obviously Andrew Strauss's role. He's been talking to the press a little bit. So I guess he's got a few things to deal with, but in a way he takes over at quite a handy time with England playing so well. But, you know, their test performances have been resurrected and their one-day performances are, a bit, you know, through the roof.
You need to be careful, though, when seemingly everything is going swimmingly. Remember, Paul Downton took over in 2013. England just won the Ashes at home. He was appointed and then he was going to take over full-time after the Ashes in Australia. And England, you know, everything disintegrated. That 2013 Ashes winning team disintegrated. And we had, you know, Kevin Peterson's situation. And, you know, it took a long time for the England team to recover from that. And then, of course, you know, we went on to 2015 and there was the World Cup debacle. So, you know, you think everything is moving forward nicely and things can go wrong. But, I mean, it's an incredible summer ahead. And England's test team have had an excellent last 6 months of the year. And the one-day side, world number one, everything going exceedingly well. But, you know, again, that could all fall apart in a semi-final defeat, couldn't it, if they get there?
It's been an interesting sort of couple of years for Giles, hasn't it? Because he took over as England's one-day coach for a while, and then he stopped that. He was sort of got rid of there.
Well, I was there the day that they lost to Holland or the Netherlands in the World T20 in Chittagong. And I remember going round the boundary and you could see this game slipping away from them, thinking, they can't lose to the Netherlands again in the World T20, because it happened, of course, at Lord's in 2009. They can't lose again. Ashley Giles is in charge. It sort of felt at the time, whether it was the case or not, it felt at the time he was on trial for his job. You know, he was going to become the next coach. And then he saw this debacle happening in front of you, and you thought, oh no. And for him, you know, because he was a shoe-in for the job, or seemingly a shoe-in for the job.
As head coach.
As head coach. Well, yeah. Favourite for the job, anyway. That's how it seemed at the time, whether he was a shoo-in or not. I mean, clearly he wasn't, because he didn't get the
it
job.
It shows that coaches are hostage to performance.
Well, exactly.
Aren't
I remember walking around the boundary thinking, I've got to speak to Ashley Giles. This is an awful moment for him. And he came out and he emerged at the end of the game. And his face, told the story, just utterly crestfallen. I mean, he put a brave face on it, he spoke really well. But he must have known. It was a devastating performance for the England team and for him personally, I think. And it obviously reflects on the coach, doesn't it? It's very hard to then appoint a coach who's just lost to the Netherlands in the World T20.
And then, of course, he was a selector, one of the three selectors with Angus Fraser and Mike Newell from Notts. And then they disbanded that selection committee and brought in Ed Smith. And, of course, he's been director of cricket at Warwickshire all that time as well. So he's had a mixed career. I guess, in a way, director of cricket sits above selectors and coaches, so you're less vulnerable, perhaps, than some of the people at the coalface.
Yeah, what does the managing director of England cricket do? What does the director of cricket do? What's their job?
Well, their job is to appoint the coaches and the captain, in consultation, I suppose, with the coaches. I think it's also to make sure. I know Strauss had a lot of involvement in Loughborough and the coaching below the top level, Lions, the academy, very much Loughborough and all that, which got nicknamed Bluffborough for a while, I think slightly unfairly. So that whole infrastructure.
Why Bluffborough?
Well, because they were sort of bluffing their way through, I suppose. That was the theory. But I feel there are a lot of pretty hard-working, interesting people at Loughborough. But you do need a bit of a refresh every so often. I mean, coaches are like teachers. You know, you can get bored with them. They can sort of trot out the same things over and over again. And sometimes you need a bit of new blood, a few new ideas, new concepts. So I suppose Giles's job primarily will be to think about the succession for Trevor Bayliss, who's giving up his coaching role at the end of the summer. They need to find somebody for the winter onwards, and that probably might apply to Paul Farbrace as well, because Farbrace and Bayliss are very much kind of, Tweedledum and Tweedledee in a way, aren't they? So that's a thing for him to look ahead to. And the interesting thing is, listening to him talking today, the question was posed, can you split the job now? Is it too demanding to have a coach doing both Test cricket and One Day cricket? And he was slightly sitting on the fence on that one.
I guess back when we first split coaches with Andy with the Test team, me with the One Days, we thought we might see the paths of players going similarly. I think what we've seen actually is players coming together more. We've got a very adaptable group of players who can play across forms. And actually, if you look at where those players come from, our county system, it's very unlikely nowadays you're going to try and develop one skill players or one form players, because it's just not efficient. There are still going to be guys who only play one form, but the other bit for me to consider is just the culture of the team, because naturally with different leaders you have different sorts of cultures, and that was certainly the case with me and Andy. Doesn't make either culture wrong, we're just different people, so you lead differently, and if you've got different leaders and the same group of players in a room, then that can have its own challenges as well. I think whatever we do, whether it's two coaches or one coach, I think we need to make it normal and acceptable that coaches have time off and are able to go and watch some cricket or just have a break. And in that way, you can also develop your other coaches to lead. The programme, the way it is over the next couple of years, is extremely busy. To expect one head coach or two head coaches to be there all the time is going to be it's quite challenging.
What do you think, then? Can you split the jobs, or does England need one coach?
It's a very good question, actually. And I think that in the past, the last 4 years, probably was worth splitting the job, because the two formats, test match, one day formats, were diverging quite significantly. And you've got almost completely different squads arriving for a one day series and the test squad going home. But I think now, if you look at the England side, there are more and more players playing both. They've sort of realised that, they want to be involved in all formats. And so sometimes players have to be rested from, one day series or whatever. But generally, players want to play both. So actually, you can see a logic in having a coach operating in both formats. the same coach or the same coach and his deputy, and they can share it, as Bayliss and Fabrice have. Bayliss sort of take over in one series in charge, and then he'll have a rest and Fabrice will be in charge for a one-day series or something like that. So that's worked quite well. And the other thing is, for me, that the head coaches are facilitators, principally, bringing in the experts, the specialists in batting, bowling, fielding, keeping, spin bowling, etc. And so they can still bring in appropriate specialists for different formats.
Yeah, the only thing is, I mean, it seems to me that for the head coach, it is such a demanding role there. England plays so much cricket. You're there not just right from the start, right to the end of every tour, but also doing the planning for each tour and then the debriefing after each tour. There is so much to do. Mm. And the demands are so great. Is it worth having someone who looks after white ball cricket, someone who looks after red ball cricket? I mean, that's the argument. That's what Ashley Giles, that's the solution he'll have to sort out, isn't it? The problem he'll have to sort out.
Yeah, it's not a simple one. I don't know. I just don't think you want necessarily too many different philosophies coming into the same, to essentially the same group of players. But you're right. Someone like Johnny Bairstow, I think, played something like 73 days of cricket for England in a year. So, that's one in 5 days. I mean, that is plus all the training and travelling as well. So it is incredibly demanding. The coaches have even more demands in a way than the players, because there's so much they've got to do behind the scenes.
Which is one thing you would say, is a player would hope to have an England career, if you're really successful, that would last, say, 10 or 12 years. For a coach, I mean, Trevor Bayliss, there is a shelf life, isn't there? There's a certain length of time, 4 years, say. When you do the job, you put everything into it, you earn very good money. An England coach earns very good money. You're almost, not quite set up for life, but it helps you, certainly helps you set up for the rest of your life to be the England coach for 4 years. But it is an extremely demanding role. I suppose what it comes down to is do you need a different coaching philosophy for the two different roles? But you're saying that actually the two teams, England in the England situation. There's a lot of overlap between the two sets of players.
I think that one of the key roles for the limited overs format is data analysis. Mm. And if you get somebody that's really sharp on that, getting the right sources. I've been to a place in Chennai recently, which is basically like the Big Brother of cricket, looking at every game played all around the world, videoing it, recording it, making sort of packages, video packages about individual players, looking at, if for instance, they were looking at Imran Tahir's leg breaks and googlies and the different grips, and then sending those out to their appropriate clients to help them deal with Imran Tahir's variations, and making lots of statistical packages of how to approach certain players or certain situations. There's lots of data available out there. You need one person to be able to simulate all that and come up with sensible strategies, which then can be sort of passed on to the coach, and they can buy into it or not, as the case may be. I think you still can do that with one main coach.
Yeah. Who was that main coach going to be, though?
Someone like Stephen Fleming, I would think about, because he's done very well in the shorter format, but he obviously made his career playing very well for New Zealand in Test cricket. He's a very, loads of integrity, been all around the world. You probably want somebody who's a bit more au fait with English cricket, which I think Trevor Bayliss is. That was his one drawback, was when he first came into the job, he said, well, I don't watch county cricket, I don't know him, and I haven't seen him play before. And he was perhaps a bit foolish to say that, because you can look at everything on video nowadays anyway, so you didn't have to admit you haven't seen anyone before, and that just sounds a bit feeble as a coach. But he sort of corrected that over time. I'm now arguing for somebody who's also overseas. It would be great if we had a homebred coach, an English coach, but you've got to look around the world and see who's the best at the job. And at the moment, the English coaches are not sought after in overseas franchises and things. Why that is, I'm not quite sure.
Well, Ashley Giles was asked about that in his press conference. Do you want an overseas coach? Do you think it should be an English coach? And he sort of said, well, he sort of said preferably an English coach. That was what we would like, and we need to develop English coaches. But I'm not ruling out an overseas coach. So there we are with that. The field is wide open.
One other little thing, very important, the coaching role. Got to be able to be a left-handed nicker for the slips, because Phil Neal, who's been with the England team forever, 20-odd years, is the right-handed nicker. Right. you know, edging the ball for the slips for right-handed batsmen. But in the past, we've had Andy Flower, we've had, you know, Strauss, people like that around who can do the left-handed nicking. But they haven't really got anybody to do the left-handed nicking now. I can't think of that. There isn't anybody on the coaching staff who can do that. And it's very valuable. With a lot of left-handed batsmen around, you need someone who's good at that left-handed nicking. So that's why Stephen Fleming fits the bill.
You can't just bring someone in, a left-handed nicker for the day, to prepare the players.
No,
you
know, true.
For an hour before each day's play.
No, it's a bit facetious. Yeah. But it's a useful little thing on your CV. I'm good at nicking.
Yeah. So Trevor Braziers is going after the Ashes, the end of the season, and then it's on to New Zealand and South Africa. So the coach will have to be in place for that. That's the future. But I mean, there's an awful lot to focus on before that happens. Yeah. And I suppose the other thing, for Ashley Giles as well, and that the big question is he as the new managing director of England cricket, is he going to let the players play football?
And he says that he's got very strong views about this. Let's hear them.
Everyone knows my thoughts on football, and I will discuss that with the captains and the coaches, but I think when you talk about short-term derailers, I don't want to be blamed for losing the World Cup because we're not playing football in a month's time, but it's certainly, if you look at what football does, the benefits from a psychological point of view and fun point of view, I think are outstripped by the dangers, but we'll discuss that. I'm not coming in with an iron rod right now.
So it sounds as if football's banned before the World Cup, I reckon, and maybe they'll get it back for the Ashes. Mm. I don't know. But it sounds as if he just thinks the risks are too much. Yeah. And I'm sure Johnny Bairstow would probably agree.
Yeah, well, but a lot of the players, they like it. It's part of the sort of camaraderie of touring. We've talked about this before.
Stress relief as much as anything. Yeah, but also exercising and getting ready, warmed up for the day.
Yeah, I mean, you always hear Bumble say, I haven't seen Manchester United go out and play cricket before they're playing Liverpool or Bayern Munich or whatever in the Champions League. But you see the South Africans play rugby, don't you? Touch rugby before, as part of their warm-ups.
You know, actually, in defence of the football, which everyone says, oh, it's a bit of a risk, you know, and then Sam Billings on this show a few weeks ago said, well, you could get injured doing anything. Yeah. And he's right, because Billy Stanlake, in the Big Bash Australian fast bowler, trod on the boundary rope doing one of those close boundary catching in practice, and he was out. And actually, I saw today Ashton Agar, the left-arm spinner, just went over on his ankle catching the ball at extra cover, throwing it to mid-off during a game and had to go off. So, you know, you can get injured anyhow, but it seems as if that potential collision of players who are naturally competitive in a footballing environment and a little bit inclined to show off if there's a bit of a crowd watching that warm-up game, there is a little bit of a risk there, I can see.
Actually, I think it's surprising that more
injuries...
There haven't been more injuries. Yeah, actually, there have been relatively few football injuries over the years. So I think that you should bear that in mind as well.
So there's a spate of them coming up.
Well, no, what I'm saying is that inevitably, as you just said, you could get injured doing anything. Inevitably, over the years, people are going to get injured, doing cricket warm-ups or bowling the nets or whatever. So is football that big a deal? I'm not sure it necessarily is. That's my point, is that they've played so much football over the years and there have been so few injuries that really, is it such a big
Let's get
issue?
The ping-pong table out instead. Wheel a ping-pong table out on the outfield.
A game of chess beforehand. And then someone would hurt their finger, wouldn't they, moving the piece.
Imagine that. Or throw something down with annoyance when their king was taken.
Exactly.
And lose it.
If you have your king taken, that's the end of... End of a chess match.
But you're going to throw your pieces out and, you know, slam the board on your fingers or whatever. Yeah. God. But good luck to Ashley Giles. He's a great man. He's done a business degree recently, so he's good on the sort of man management side. He knows the game inside out. He's got lots of assets.
Well, the point you say he knows the game inside, he knows the county game as well. So there's quite a good bridge between him and, you know, all the county coaches and those who run the county game. I think there was a feeling among some of the counties that Andrew Strauss was a bit distant from the county game, was Ashley Giles is sort of embedded in the county game. His job's at Lancashire and Warwickshire, so that might be a bit, you know.
And he's a straightforward, honest as the day is long guy. You won't get any, you know, bullshit from him. You know, he's a very decent man. And presumably his appointment will coincide with a spate of sales of the King of Spain mugs at Edgbaston as well, so they're going to be pleased.
Yeah. Better tell the story, those who don't know it, the King of Spain.
Well, it was a misprint, wasn't it? Yeah. He was King of Spin during the Ashes one year, and there was a misprint on the mugs, and it came out as King of Spain.
Yeah.
But they sold probably more as a result of it coming out as King of Spain than King of Spin.
Long live the King of Spain.
Correct. And we'll take a break at that point, and we'll come back and review Australia-India and give you the Ashes ticket winners. Right, now the first thing we're going to do in this second half is answer Marina's riddle, okay. I think. Very important.
Okay.
So let's just hear it first.
In a forest there's a river, in a river there's a boat, in a boat there's a girl with the green, green coat, and if you don't know her name, you better listen again, because I said it in the middle of the riddle, what's her name?
Okay, so what's the answer?
Anne.
Anne. So Anne is in the middle there somewhere. That is the name of the girl. Now, if you've got any other riddles that are maybe cricket-related, do send them in. We'd like to hear them. We can read one out per podcast. The email address is theanalystpodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet us as well, @theanalyst, or @cricket_man. And we'll read out the best riddle of the week. So, no winners for that one. Well, you're the winner, because you know...
It took me a long time to get it, and she had to say it very slowly before I got it.
Okay, without further ado, we should announce the winners, the real winners, of the Ashes tickets. This is for the Saturday of the Lord's Test, the second test of the Ashes series in August. And the winners are, from your emails and your suggestions of things that cricket could do to innovate, Tom Coles, James Webb, John Boys and Louise Bostock, and all of you at some point will receive two tickets to the Lord's Test for the Saturday. So hope you enjoy those. The main thing is to send us your email address first, but I'll communicate with you on that. So congratulations and thanks for all your support. And keep the emails coming in for suggestions for topics, comments, the fact that you like Bristol or don't like Bristol, you know, anything you like. So, with that Ashes sort of segue, Australia-India,
yeah,
which both of us have been watching. I've been watching it sort of sitting up in the night. I think you've been watching it on sort of record in the morning. Yeah. And it was a fascinating series. Here's a great fact. Marcus Harris's 79 in the series was the highest score by an Australian in the series, and it's the lowest, highest score by an Australian in a home test series for 100 years.
It's incredible, isn't it? And the axe has been wielded for the Sri Lanka series.
Well, he survived.
Because he survived,
The highest score. Got two of the highest scores, in fact.
But in come Joe Burns, Will Pukowski and Matt Renshaw for the Sri Lanka series. So the Marsh brothers, who a year ago, I was in Sydney.
We're tonking England everywhere.
They both scored hundreds in the last Ashes test at Sydney. They've gone. They're out. Finch has gone as well. Who else has gone? Uncle Tom Cobley, he's gone. But, I mean, you know, it's
Hanscom. I mean,
Hanscom,
in and out, like, you know, yo-yo, isn't it?
It's a bit like his innings. He's in and then out. I mean, he's really struggled. He doesn't look to have the technique to cope, does he?
No.
And the Australian selectors have recognised that.
Australian selectors, they are suffering a serious outbreak of indecision.
Well, it's a bit like the England selectors in the 1990s, isn't it? Chopping and change. Or the late 80s, 90s, just chopping and change. Not sure.
13 Australians have made their debut in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
They've had, and they just sort of seem to be. And there's some more there you've just mentioned that are going to play in the Sri Lanka series. And they're dragging people out of the ether. And the problem they've got is that they're dropping somebody with a first class average of 33 to replace them with somebody with an average of 32 or 34. There's nobody out there who is really sort of saying pick me. And it goes back to Tim Payne actually after the series was asked. What did you think about the fact that Mike Hussey, when he made his test debut in 2005, had scored 10,000 first-class runs?
Mm.
And Tim Payne looked a bit exasperated and said, well, we don't produce players like Mike Hussey or Jamie Cox or Stuart Law anymore, and we've just got to work with what we've got. It's fantasy land to think we're going to produce players like that now. We don't produce those sort of cricketers.
One of the other problems they've got, of course, as well, if you're picking for a test series, we're right in the middle of an extended Big Bash. So the first-class season in Australia has been suspended since...
So they've got nowhere to practice, nowhere preparing, playing long innings. And, Matt Renshaw recalled to the team, I think you said he's averaging 19 or something in the Shield this year.
Yeah, but Matthew Wade, who's had a great Shield year, can't get in the side because
Tim Payne.
Because Tim Payne is the captain.
And that's an irony because, you know, Australia were innovators themselves in the 90s. Adam Gilchrist raised the bar in terms of a number seven wicketkeeper who totally changed the game. 17 test hundreds, an average of nearly 50, totally just tore the game away from a team, ravaged tired bowlers, gave the Australians those huge totals to play with. And now they've got Tim Payne, who averages around 30-odd in test cricket and less in first class. He's actually averaging 29 in first class cricket. He only has one first class 100, no test hundreds, and he's batting at number seven in that pivotal spot, which the Indians have shown the way there with Rishabh Pant, who's, you know, pumping the ball all over the place at number seven. The Australians look like dinosaurs with Tim Payne, a lovely guy, but to me, inadequate as a wicketkeeper batsman at number seven.
Yeah, they haven't, obviously, they haven't recovered from the sandpaper gate in South Africa. They're still, you know, feeling the heat of that, really. They do have Smith to come back, and potentially they have Warner to come back, and possibly they have Bancroft to come back as well. Will they be able to just reintegrate into the team and also get their games going, their international games going after such a long break, remains to be seen. I know that Smith, actually, and Warner are playing in the Bangladesh Premier League. Actually, which brings me on to quite just as a side point, actually brings me on to something about, you know, comparing the Big Bash and the Bangladesh Premier League. I've watched a lot of the Big Bash this year, commentated on it for the BBC, and also worked with BT Sport as well, as you have. And I wonder whether the Big Bash is just losing a bit in comparison with someone like the Bangladesh Premier League. I know it doesn't help when you've got Smith and Warner playing there, but you've got, you know, De Villiers, for example, is playing there. All the West Indians are playing in the Bangladesh Premier League. Two overseas players in Big Bash. It's very much a sort of domestic competition to showcase the best Australian players. The pitches have not been great so far. So
I think the Big Bash is looking really ordinary. I've seen a few games, and I think the standard is much lower than the Vitality Blast,
really?
And probably the other tournaments that you mentioned there. It just looks... they're missing a lot of the international players. Obviously, the Test players and now the One Day international players are out, and it just looks tame, actually, the Big Bash. Plus the fact they're now doing 6 weeks, 8 weeks Big Bash with 14 games instead of 8. And so it's stretched out much longer. There's less intensity about it. The crowds are much thinner. It just doesn't have the same buzz at all.
It's amazing, isn't it? You can go for a year ago, Australia. Remember the was it the four hands or the four fingers for the 4-0? You know, everything was triumphant about Australian cricket. They just pumped England in the ashes. A year later,
12 months is a long time in cricket.
It is, and they are really struggling. England seem to have gone the other way, and there's still time for them for it to go.
Well, Australia are now, I think, sixth in the ICC rankings in Test cricket, and England are up to second. Mm. So it's amazing how it's changed, actually, in 12 months. Now, one of the things we did in this podcast last year was a high light and a low light, which we seem to have forgotten a bit recently. But I'm going to give you a low light. Well, actually, no, I'm going to give you a highlight and a low light. Yeah. I'm going to give you a highlight. Cheteshwar Pujara. Mm. I mean, the most phenomenal series. 500 runs. Guy who doesn't play any T20, hasn't played an IPL game for 4 years, hasn't played any T20 for a year and a half, and doesn't care about the riches. He was asked after the last test, in which he scored 193, whether he cared about playing white ball cricket. No, he said, no, I'm happy to go home, work on my red ball skills and come back even stronger. They haven't got any tests till the summer now, the Indians. But he, you know, sort of said, well, that's fine. You know, I'm happy to just go home, and I've got a little baby at home. I've enjoyed my batting. I mean, his concentration, old school, just total devotion to the crease, not playing anything out of his own comfort zone, absorbed, took a few blows on the body, but just stuck it out for his country. Fantastic performance. The Australians, they were sick of the sight of him by the end.
Reminds me of Alistair Cook, actually, in 2010-11. Australians saying, I'll drive him to the airport. Let's get him out of our country. And the series reminds me of 2010-11 as well, where a strong team from overseas goes to Australia there and sort of gets amongst them and turns them into a bit of a rabble. I think that's what's happened in this series. And India, they would have won, but for the Sydney weather, they would have won 3-1 and quite convincingly so as well.
The other highlight for me of that series was Jasprit Bumrah's bowling, phenomenal. And, you know, not only was he constantly at the batsman all the time and producing unplayable deliveries, using variety, using the Yorker and the slower ball, which you don't see that often in Test cricket now, but he had the intelligence to change the game with key wickets with those sort of deliveries. But also, he's so accurate, he just never let the batsman off the hook. His economy rate in the series, 2.27. Mm. That's up there with the West Indian greats of the 1980s. Just never let the batsman get away. Doesn't bowl bad balls. Whether he can sustain that pace and potency with that strange run up and action, I don't know. You know, he learnt to bowl in a corridor, and that's why his arms are sort of so stiff and sort of close to his body all the time.
What was it, indoor cricket?
Some kind of indoor, or like an indoor space, a covered space with narrow sides, so he couldn't sort of let his arms swing. He couldn't be like a Morney Morkel or a Malinga or someone like that with arms, you know, much wider arm span. But fantastic. Low light, going off for bad light. Yeah. And Sydney.
Low light, bad light.
Low light. Yeah. But I mean, what is this that players, the umpires, who say, oh no, the light's looking a bit gloomy, the floodlights have overtaken the natural light, which is written into the playing conditions, so it's not entirely their fault. And then they go off for bad light with the floodlights blazing, you know, top whack. And you look at this empty ground, no fielders, no players on it, and the light looks fine. It's caused, you know, quite a lot of comment on Twitter here. You know, David Grant says, is this not madness? The lights are on. Cricket does itself no favours at times. Get on with it. I'm happily having a beer. So he was at the game. He couldn't believe it.
It's a really good point that we play day-night test cricket, but we can't play day test cricket under lights. I mean, I tentatively put this suggestion forward, and it's not ideal. It's not ideal, but surely it's about playing the game. And some people say, oh, no, it's about the integrity of test match cricket and getting the balance right, and I accept that totally. But are we now in a situation where if there is bad light, I'm sorry, we just get the pink ball out and we say, right, I'm sorry, we're going to have to play with the pink ball for now. A pink ball
that's what David Cook suggests.
Yeah,
actually.
Similarly aged to the one you're actually playing with. And then when the light improves, you go back to the red ball. I know it's not ideal, but surely, you know, just having an empty ground and spectators in it and the lights are on, we can't go on with this.
No, you know,
for example, if you turn up as your batsman, if you turn up and it's a lovely sunny day, you think, great, this is my day. But the next day, the opposition turn up and it's overcast and it's just the lack of the draw,
isn't it?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. That's all part of the sort of variables of test match cricket. So I wonder whether we need to look at that. I mean, I suspect they won't, because cricket is like that.
It's hidebound by law, isn't it, all the time?
And people say, well, actually, no, it would skew the game too much. And I accept, actually, the pink balls aren't great at the moment, so perhaps there needs to be more study or more development of pink balls, get a better quality of pink balls. But, I mean, that strikes
me. Well, the one that they played with in England, the Duke's pink ball, which they played with against the West Indies, it did a fair bit, admittedly, under lights. It's not easy to bat against, but the ball's condition, I looked at it after 80 overs, it was absolutely fine when they changed it for a new one. It was still in good condition. So that is definitely a feasible idea. We can't carry on losing this time. And also, while we're on this subject, you know, over rates, the Indians managed to bowl 90 overs in a day comfortably when the spinners were bowling. And that's another area. And so I think, you know, this is something we can talk about again later, but with the World Test Championship starting in July, and the first series are in India and in the West Indies, actually, but the Ashes will be the sort of big grandstand opening of the World Test Championship. Points, 120 points per match available. They've got to start, I reckon, they've got to start docking points for terrible over rates, and that will certainly pinch the players where it hurts.
Well, I've gone on about overrates for a while, and people go, oh, well, he's going on about overrates again, and nothing more boring.
But it is boring. But it needs sorting.
There's nothing more boring. You're a spectator. You paid your money, and you want to see players getting on with the game and giving full 90 overs in a day's play. It's the old chestnut. You know, you have a football match, it's 4-4 after 85 minutes. You don't say, well, that was exciting for everybody. Let's just go home now. You've had your excitement for the day. We're going to knock off the last 10 minutes of the game, you know, the last 5 minutes and 5 minutes of stoppage time. No, you go on, you play it all, see where it goes. So, get on with the game and keep the game going as well. I mean, I suspect using a pink ball in a Red Bull test match, it will never happen. I suspect that, might be the case. But it certainly is one solution to the problem if someone is prepared to be, broad-minded about it. I mean, it needs everyone on board. I'm sure there'll be players going, no, we don't want to do that, especially batsmen, perhaps even some bowlers as well. I don't know, they don't like bowling with a pink ball. But it's about this, it's important for the spectators to keep the game going. It's important for the game.
Very important. Well, sorry about that long-winded whinge. listen, if you've got views on that, overrates or bad light, you've got solutions, we'd love to hear them. TheAnalystPodcast@gmail.com. Let us know.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that's viable? Your cricket supporters out there, do you think that playing with a pink ball, substituting a pink ball in a Red Bull test match is acceptable, or do you think it's a step too far? I mean, I know people say, certain things are a step too far, but we've gone a long way down the line in test match cricket with various things. Just having floodlights for a start, the fact that you can challenge an umpire's decision. We've come a long way since I started watching the games. The game is always changing, and that change is a part of life, I'm afraid. Some people don't like change, but it's a part of life. So is that a step too far? Let us know.
Absolutely. Right, that's the end for this week. We'll call it off this week. Next week...
Bad lights stop playing.
Well, it is pretty gloomy out there. Next week, I've got an interview with a man who's just started his new job at the headquarters of cricket. Now, who's that? Not Ashley Giles. Who's that?
I don't know his name.
Carl McDermott.
But I know what he does.
Carl McDermott. What is he?
He's the new Lords Groundsman.
Correct.
Taking over from Mick Hunt.
He is. And he's just started work, and I'm going to talk to him about pitches and working at Lords and what it's been like so far moving from the Aegeus Bowl, where, of course, he was for a number of years. So that's coming up next week. In the meantime, thanks for listening.
Goodbye for now.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.